Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. And I'm very happy to say that Stan is going to introduce the panel that we have here with us this morning. So I'll let Stan get started.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
All right, that's pretty good. I'm Stan Lindhorst. I'm the Director of Special Projects for the Syracuse Media Group. And those of you listening live here at TMR know that I'm a member of your group. I usually sit over close to the coffee, so if I sneak over there during the presentation, you'll know I needed another jolt. So I'm going to moderate today's panel, and we want to save plenty of time for your questions. The subject that Eileen handed to us was ethics and journalism. So I think that will probably provoke plenty of questions from you as well. My first task, though, is to give you a brief introduction for our five panelists. So there are five, so I'm going to be pretty brief. And I'm going to read it off as I have it here, not as they're sitting. So wave when I say your name. I'm going to start with Matt Mulcahy. Good job, Matt. We're off to a fine start. Matt was born in Syracuse, grew up in Liverpool. He earned his master's degree in management and leadership from Binghamton University and a bachelor's degree in broadcast journalism from Ithaca College. And he's also completed the entrepreneurship boot camp at Syracuse University. And Matt, as you probably know, anchors the NBC3 News at 5, 6, and 11. So he was on late last night, as well as the CW6 News at 10. He's won several awards, too many to mention. One thing I would like to mention is Matt is the co-founder of the Shamrock Animal Fund. You probably know about it. It's a not-for-profit organization that helps pet care. And I should also mention Matt is filling in for Ray Fulkerson, the news director of CNY Central, who couldn't be with us this morning. Next, I'll go to Iris St. Moran. Hi, Iris. Iris is a reporter who joined Time Warner Cable News in February 2008 in the Mohawk Valley Bureau in Utica. She now reports weekdays from the Syracuse headquarters. She's originally from Boston and is a graduate of Emerson College. And she says when she's not working, she enjoys singing, listening to live music, and as a Bostonian, she likes to cheer for the Celtics, the Patriots, and don't hold this against her, please.
And the Red Sox.
The Red Sox.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Dan Cummings. Dan has spent 37 years in radio and television right here in Central New York, most of it with Channel 9, where he is the managing editor and an anchor, the morning anchor. He also has won a number of awards for his journal and his professional standards, again, too many for me to list. Dan was born and raised in Cayuga County, southern Cayuga County. He holds a bachelor's degree from SUNY Geneseo and a master's degree from Cornell University. Next, we have Chris Bolt. Chris says he was destined for a career in radio when he built his first stereo receiver from a Heathkit box. That's what he emailed me. I'm glad you're cheering because I had to Google, what the heck is a Heathkit? So now I know about your childhood, Chris, and what kind of guy you were. It's an electronics kit. Chris came to Syracuse to finish a broadcast journalism degree at SU's Newhouse School. He's worked at WAER, the SU public radio station, since 1990. And by the way, we're neighbors in a way because he lives in the same downtown condo. He has an apartment several floors above the Syracuse Media Group right on Warren Street. Chris is WAER's news director, and we probably on this panel all train interns and get interns from the Newhouse School or elsewhere. But for Chris, as an SU radio station, training students is a key part of his mission. And I hope we'll find out a little bit more about how he trains students in the ethics of journalism. And finally, but clearly not least because he's my boss, is Steven Svengros. Steven is vice president of content for the Syracuse Media Group. He oversees editorial for Syracuse.com, The Post Standard, and NewYorkUpstate.com. Stephen came to Syracuse from MSN in Seattle, where he worked as executive producer of multiple editorial sites during 15 years with Microsoft. Previously, he held management roles at the Chicago Tribune, the Detroit News, and CompuServe. And I remember CompuServe. I was a CompuServe member. Many of us probably were. He and his wife, Amber, live in Sedgwick with their world-famous dog, Schmoosh. Now, in case you think I'm kidding about world famous, I had to look up Schmoosh's Facebook page, which I follow and you all should too, and it is followed by more than 230,000 people around the world. Schmoosh is one of our biggest stars in Central New York. So, with that introduction, We'll move on, because I'd like to get this panel talking, and I suspect they'll have plenty to say about today's topic. What I did is I asked each one of them to be prepared, and we'd go down the panel to list two or three ethical issues that they deal with sometimes in their newsrooms. We'll start with that, and we'll see if any themes or trends or disagreements emerge. And then during the course of our discussion, Eileen will signal me to make sure we have plenty of time for questions. So, panelists, let's start with that, and we'll just go right down the line. We'll start with you, Dan. What are two or three ethical issues you face regularly?
Thanks, Stan. And I'll be brief because I do want to save as much time as possible for you all to talk to us. But what I want to say is not going to sound a lot like ethical questions or dilemmas. For me, in television news, as a morning anchor, which is what I've done for the past 8 years, I'm the managing editor for the newsroom, but I work a shift that doesn't allow me to do too much managing or too much editing anymore. But to the extent that I can, every day, the ethical issue becomes, what stories do we choose to cover? And of the stories we've already chosen to cover the previous evening or the previous day, what stories belong in that morning newscast? With such a short period of time to show and tell a busy morning audience, something that matters, something that's lasting. And the issue of, I think, ethics in today's television news, not to mention the digital era that we'll talk about more later, is the brevity with which we are almost forced to deliver information. And too often, the ethical issue becomes a leaning back on what we call spot news. Or if there's something that's burned or someone that's been hurt overnight or something that looks like it's a calamity, we cover that. And it's the daily issue, I guess, Stan, of trying to make sure we put something in the news, every newscast, even in the early morning when it's really moving fast, that can at least offer some lasting benefit to people beyond last night's house fire or this morning's accident. Now, that may not sound like a terrible ethical dilemma, but it's the nature of the business I work in, and it is a dilemma every day.
Chris?
Thanks. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed doing this, and I'm glad that we get an opportunity to talk about our profession. I know in my newsroom, many of my reporters are always talking about, boy, I wonder how the audience knows how we cover this or why we cover that or something. In fact, somewhat related to what Dan was talking about, trying to figure out in a day where we cover three or four stories that we put out and make phone calls on or go out into the field, et cetera. So I really am happy to participate in anything that, you know, pulls back the curtain and you get to see the wizard back there. One of the things I wanted to discuss just briefly is a difference between like balance and fairness and objectivity. A lot of times some story will happen where you're covering a protest or somebody making a strong comment about something that's newsworthy. Two recent examples I can think of are some of the protesters over the drone operations out of Hancock. So needless to say, the people who do those protests have a very specific point of view that not everyone shares. That could be true on an environmental issue. It could be true on abortion. It could be true on minimum wage, as Governor Cuomo's going around the state now. Another one that we've covered recently was the Supreme Court, you know, reactions to the Supreme Court replacement debate. And people have come out with strong comments. We talked to our Congress member at another event, but we also talked to some of the challengers, to Mr. Katko, some of the Democratic challengers, who put forth pretty strong statements. So we judged that that was newsworthy, but what do you cover? What do you put on the air that is fair and balanced? Well, if you are approaching a story, say about controversial topic like abortion or education, you'd certainly want to get all sides to do so. And if you were doing a long newspaper or magazine piece or documentary or something, that's what you do. When you're covering the protest, however, the story is the protest. So you didn't approach that as a completely fair and balanced version of that issue. So then you have to kind of decide, well, what's fair to the audience and fair to, you know, the issue. So you cover the protest, but you have to acknowledge the other side. Now, that may be calling somebody to get a comment. It may be that you just literally say in some form in the, as Dan was saying, a very brief radio piece, you acknowledge to a listener that there is another side. So if you want to pursue it further, it at least acknowledges that, you know, this isn't a view that's held by most people. At the same time, say you go to that same protest and there's a counter-protest, but there's 400 protesters and 3 counter-protesters. Most of the time on that story, you will hear equally from both of those. Is that fair? Now, there's not rights or wrongs to all these things, but it's an issue we deal with quite often because this is an active community around a lot of issues. And we do probably tend in our news coverage to focus a little more on an issue like that than the daily crimes or, you know, traffic types or something, you know, both because of the amount of local news we do, which is a little smaller amount inside of NPR programming, but also to kind of get those thought pieces going a little bit more. So just one thing I wanted to talk about, maybe we'll discuss that further or with your questions. Thank you.
Okay, up next. So I am a video journalist, and what that means is in addition to being a reporter, I'm also the camera person. I write the story and I edit the story. It does get copy edited before it ends up on air. So when there is breaking news, if I don't already have an assignment, I may be dispatched to a fire, a car accident, whatever crime scene there may be. So when I get to the scene, you know, my main priority is to gather video. And in those situations, you may come across something that is very graphic, and I try to just gather it all. But just because I capture it on video on my camera doesn't mean it'll end up on air. My station has a philosophy that we don't show blood. So those are some of the things that we weigh. You know, what does a viewer need to see? Is this necessary? And things like that. And same things with interviews. You may encounter people who are very emotional. Sometimes they don't want you there, even though it is a crime scene. There are police there. They may be angry. You know, do you approach this person to interview them? So it's, you know, what do we show? Who do we show? What do we show them saying? We weigh that every day. So that's what I do on a daily basis.
I'd like to take it from theoretical to practical and reality. This week has been as difficult a week as we've had in the news in quite a while. Obviously, Baby Maddox discovery and the Amber Alert that started Sunday morning, and the father being taken in by police Monday afternoon, and then the search that intensified Tuesday morning, and the police news conference, and the arraignment, and the district attorney talking, and the police chief talking, and if you want to talk about ethical discussions, it's been a constant ethical discussion and deliberation within our business virtually every hour of the day over the last 3 or 4 days. And you can't help but discuss ethics balanced against what our primary job is to tell people what's going on in their community and to inform people and to peel back the curtain of what's going on with police and prosecutors and explain to you who are intensely curious to find out what's going on in a story the best information that we have at any given moment. While in a competitive media environment, Dan mentioned the digital side that we could talk about later, but I'm sure Stephen could tell you, and or maybe he shouldn't tell you the exact numbers, but there was a day this week that was probably as big a day on any of our websites in terms of traffic as there has ever been, by 20-fold. You know, you could see numbers in the analytics realm that were showing all of you on your phones, your iPads, maybe your desktops, at levels that are just... The only thing I can think of that rivals it in our community routinely is a terrible winter storm, which was also a universal and obviously not as tragic of an event. And layering that in, there's Twitter and there's Facebook primarily as the social media outlets that we're using where we're seeing a quarter of a million people share a group of pictures in 6 hours or sharing Baby Maddox's photo by the thousands instead of by a couple dozen, you know, which would be more typical. So the scale of a story like this that's fallen truly into our community's lap this week creates constant pressures for getting the story right, getting the story first, getting the story out in a way that is sensitive to the community, to the family, while still being honest and detailed in your reporting and explain to people what happened. So there's a lot, we don't need to say, well, geez, ethical discussions take place at the Newhouse School of Communications. They're taking place in all of our newsrooms truly every hour of the day, in a week like this especially. And we'd be glad to talk about that some more today. Stephen?
Well, Matt, I didn't want to get to that speed bump right away because I wanted to get to ethics. I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that, but I'm going to stay with Stan's original and just talk about a few facets that we try and deal with every day. One of them, I think, may surprise you, and that is I'm constantly looking at the involvement in the community and how that impacts the way we cover something. So, an example. I have a young reporter very involved in Catholic Charities, and when we find out that he's written a story and he's involved in Catholic Charities, So we take a lot of pride at Syracuse Media Group of being involved in the community. And we have lunches where people get up and talk about groups to be involved in. Obviously, you know what we do with the old Newsboys, but there's many, many groups that our people are involved in. We very meticulously have to look at and keep, I don't want to say harping, but communicating, especially with younger journalists, that this is not the way we're going to do it. You have to step back. You have to tell us. You have to let us know ahead of time. The other aspect that I think is unique to what we do with digital is what I call fulfilling speed, accuracy, and quality. And that means that I look for all three of those. I don't look for any two. It isn't like speed and accuracy. I'm looking for speed, accuracy, and quality in what we deliver. And we're in an age, we're at a point where we are moving away from, when we moved away from Gutenberg presses and hot type to cold type to digital, and in the digital age now, we are striving to push to write stories and create information at a faster speed. And that means trying to get reporters to understand how to fulfill bulletins and build a story based on bulletin after bulletin, then write through, then bulletin, then bulletin, in a manner that does carry ethics, in a manner that does look ahead at the story and not assume any facts, but instead look at it and say, okay, I can't insert that sentence here because I'm not sure yet in the story, but I can insert this sentence. To help you all, and this is what I've used sometimes in the newsroom to understand what this means. For many, many years in newsrooms, we had the AP machine in the back room running. We had copy boys, we'd get all copy and they'd bring us over AP wire. And when President Kennedy died, it came over as a bulletin. Dallas, Dealey Plaza, and there was the bulletin. And that's now, we're sort of turning it back over and trying to teach reporters, you don't have 8 hours, 10 hours to write. Your deadline is just passed. Your deadline was 3 minutes ago. So what can you do to resolve that? But stay ethical, stay within the tenets of journalism. Someone asked me when I first came here 2.5 years ago what my belief was, and it is the same today. Good journalism first, and that's really what we're striving for. One other thing I'll say is, especially with the way that social media works and the understanding Matt referred to traffic, and look, a great understanding of traffic that we never understood with newspapers. Newspapers were always within the head of an editor saying, this is what should be out there, this is what should lead, and quite frequently, when you saw iTrack, they used to actually do a thing called iTrack at the Poynter Institute, which is for newspapers, and you could watch someone read a newspaper. Editors were totally wrong. And what we can find out in the digital age is what users really are interested in. I have to keep reminding some younger reporters especially, and they're really good at it, and they're getting it, it's interesting news. It's not just interesting, it's interesting news. So when I came there, I'll tell you very brief and then hand it off. there was a story out of, I don't know where, Asia somewhere, where there was a two-headed cat. You know, just an anomaly. And someone decided, we're going to run this because we're going to get a lot of traffic. And I said, never again. Never again. And it has seeped so far. It's all the way up into our national group. They get it. I met a guy yesterday who works our national overnight desk for the first time. He said, yeah, we know all about you and none of that cat stuff. And I'm like, no, news. And the young man who did it said, I can get a lot of traffic. I said, I can get you 10 times the traffic. I worked at MSN. I understand how to do that. But this is all news.
I don't think the audience would want to know what you really all are interested in, you know, and along that line, because the two-headed cat does get traffic. Or for that matter, as Dan mentioned, the spot news, we could get be as lazy as we could be by saying state police have just put out a news release that such and such a bad accident has happened on 81, and maybe there's a salacious detail that goes with it, and slam it online and put a headline on it, and it'll click, 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 and it's amazing. It's like watching a Las Vegas slot machine. But in the end, it's not memorable, it's not important, it didn't mean anything to the community. So I think that's an excellent point of it is our job as journalists to continue to have that sense of news and giving you things you need to know, too, not just the ones that catch your eye as you're glancing down the theoretical front page.
The one other thing to what Matt said is I believe that we're now to the point as well of reintroducing what I call utility journalism into the fray. And so I'll give you an example of utility journalism. We run the restaurant inspections every week. And you're nodding your heads.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's great, yeah.
Yeah, and people might say, why do you do it? Well, it's public record, and I'm going to tell you, the people read it. People read it and care about it and want to know about it. And that's utility journalism. We don't have to report anything other than public record, and we're doing more of that, more database work, just trying to help people have access to what is public record out there as well.
Great. If there are no rat droppings, then I still go back to the restaurant.
Sure call.
That's where I draw the line.
I had a relative who read these so he could find out where to go because he knew where there would not be a line to get in. Really. It was a good joke. Dan, I saw you nodding there a little bit, and I guess I'd like to bring it back to maybe a discussion about this digital age we're in, especially in social media, because news gets out so quickly, and we, in some ways, no longer are the gatekeepers controlling it. It just spreads at warp speed through all the social media you use, and people speculate, and others read that as real. People deliberately make stuff up. People spread that and are glad to. So anybody's sort of a publisher, and maybe a lot of them don't think about their ethical considerations in doing that. So how does all of that affect the work that we do, and what you report, how you source, how you react to what you see online? So, Dan?
Well, could I bring it back to the living laboratory that Matt brought up? Because the pressure of this digital age, I think, may have led to a difference in decision-making this week. And I'd like to ask both Stephen and Matt to explain the decision that their news organizations made at midday 2 days ago when sources had told them that the little girl's body had been recovered from the water, but the police had not yet confirmed it because the family had not been notified. But Syracuse.com, CNY Central aired that information.
Well, you just said the police have not confirmed it. That's not true.
But you reported that the body had been recovered from the water, according to a source.
Right.
And the police had not confirmed it.
No. The police had confirmed it.
Not at 12:20. They confirmed it at about 1 o'clock.
Who's they?
Police Chief Frank Fowler.
Right. Is he the only guy in the police force?
No, that's not.
Police Chief, I want to read to you something, a verbatim transcript.
So that's the key.
Chief
that you're, Dan, you're saying
so we don't
that,
get
that, we did, that the police did not confirm it. That is incorrect.
Who
the police
confirmed it for you?
Well, I don't have to tell you who confirmed it.
You know
it. Part of being a journalist.
So
we don't have to wait for the chief of police to confirm in what in essence was obvious to 50 people who were there working on that search at that time.
Let me say this, Dan. Frank Fowler also didn't identify that it was the young man they were looking for on that first afternoon.
He didn't say anything about it.
No, he didn't say anything about it. So there's an Amber Alert. Now, right. are we still looking for a man and a child, or are we looking just for a child at that point? If he comes out and says, we'll confirm that, that would have helped the community as well, and he didn't do it. So our reporters went ahead.
We confirmed on Monday evening, I talked to the Baldwinsville police chief, who told me that, yes, that was Mr. Lawrence, and he is now in the custody of the Syracuse police.
I understand
Syracuse
that.
Police said nothing about it publicly to that news conference 3 o'clock the next day.
If all
of you wanted to know what was going on.
In a moment, I'm going to put myself on the spot with another ethical issue that I'll bring up myself. But for the moment, I'd like to read what Chief Fowler told us at News Channel 9 this morning. It's a brief verbatim. May I?
Go ahead.
I really don't understand how someone could have gotten that information and we didn't have a chance to speak with the family. The family learned the information over their smartphones first, based on alerts from certain media organizations. We have to not lose sight of the fact that we're talking about human beings. This is not a made-for-TV movie here. This is real life, and real people are attached to this information that they're clamoring for. Real people are affected by that, and we should stop to pause just for a second and perhaps put ourselves in their positions and see how we would want to be treated under those circumstances. The chief of police is telling us that the smartphone alerts that went out from your media organizations were how the family of this little girl found out that the body had been recovered.
Well,
that's incredible. Why wasn't he with the family?
Why didn't he come out? Why didn't he come out and tell them? Why did he not come out initially and say, I'm not going to communicate information with you? And if you gain it within the next several hours, I would ask your consideration because we have not yet reached the family. That was no way to manage a press conference.
Well, I'm not talking about a press conference, Stephen. I'm talking about the information that was developed in the noon hour at the scene of the recovery and with the police chief. We had the same information you guys had in the same time frame and chose not to report it because we knew the family hadn't been notified. The chief told us to hold on to it. That's what I'm saying.
I'm going to jump in here for a moment to frame this just in another way, because throughout my 40-some year career, this has always been an issue. Government wants to control the flow of information, sometimes in high-minded ways, other times in for less honorable ways. But enterprising reporters usually find a way around government secrecy, or at least they try
As Channel 9 does on a regular basis and reports information that the police chief hasn't confirmed about other stories that we don't even know are going on yet because you have a relationship with members of the police department.
How important is it that we get news out quickly?
Let's go back to the free reign of the Internet and the passing of information. Much of it erroneous, that we feel it's critical that we have sort of a good housekeeping brand of if we put it out, it is news, it is verified. If we use a source, it isn't just someone talking to us. It is a source that's knowledgeable. And with the Internet as the way it flows right now, I mean, I can tell you, having watched the comments initially when Lawrence was picked up, and then I went in and said, that's it. I'm cutting all of the comments off on this story. No comments. I don't want any speculation. The speculation is crazy. And we cut it off through the story. We turned it back on yesterday, and, you know, we allowed it because also the ability to manage 40 stories at once is just ridiculous. But if you took the speculation, Dan, that was going on, what we're trying to do is offer facts as we know them. And we do not have to follow Fowler. And if Fowler does have that information, as you said, hey, I haven't told the family yet. He did not communicate that with us. So bravo for you guys.
Well, it's always a judgment call that you do that. And this community, and most of the public officials in this community, are somewhat paranoid when it comes to getting information out. So whether that's a city issue that has to do with money or a county issue that has to do with planning, you know, boring topic like that, people don't tell you things you know, and you can't confirm things you know. So at some point, it's a judgment call. Now, we're not quite in the same business as these people because we don't, you know, we're just not on the same. We're not feeding our website with the first, latest, greatest, you know, thing. That's a business that public radio is not in, We are in it. We're not in it on purpose because other media do a great job. You know, everybody here does a 50 times better job than we could if we tried to do it. We don't have the staff. It's not our
We like what you do, Chris, too, by the way.
At the same time, we still find things out that no one will confirm, but we know. And we were there. And so this is a, like, it's a real frustration on our part, and obviously something like this that's very visceral. And we can all imagine being that woman, right? Who has kids here? You know, Fowler in his press conference said that this was one of the two or three most difficult cases he's ever worked on. I can tell you the very few times I've been on air in 30 years that I've had trouble getting something out is when kids get hurt. You know, it's never their fault. There's always some crazy thing or you know, whack job or circumstance that's unforeseen. It's always tragic. Not that a murder of somebody else isn't tragic, but the kids, you know, there's an innocence to that. That's the only things I've ever had trouble getting out. So, like, I empathize with how tough this all is, and this is very visceral. But this is true about lots of issues. So that notion of saying, how can you find something out? Do you have a source that you might not name, but you trust? I mean, you almost have to trust us to say, if we put it out, and if you don't trust us, you know, that's your prerogative. It's probably our responsibility in all of our other coverage to build that trust. If you like us, you know, 11 months a year, then the 12th month, you'll take our word for it that we have a good source on that. And to tell you the truth, there's, in my opinion, there aren't hard rights or wrongs on that. I mean, one of the things that we were talking about just briefly, one more point if I could, in a bigger city, this stuff would have been managed in advance. The police chief here and the sheriff here do not have regular conversations with media. They don't issue press passes. Most communities issue press passes. We don't have press passes issued by law enforcement. So the relationship is, I'm going to have a press conference and I want to handle it the way I do if I'm the police chief or the sheriff. But media have their own job. And I got to say, in a bigger city, this would have been handled in advance. And in our city, right, it's not quite handled in advance.
Iris, but, yeah.
What I want to say is this story in particular was unique because the community was invested. There was an Amber Alert. They were told to look for certain things. There were pictures. Look for this person. Look for this child. I was at one of the locations near the Creek Walk that was shut off. You know, we were doing our news reports, but community members, neighbors, they saw that police was still searching in a harbor area, and they came down wanting to search. They were looking for information, and the challenge was we knew things, but the police couldn't confirm it, so I can't tell you. So they're wondering, do we need to continue searching? Do we need to look for this? So that's one of the things that we weigh. And because the community was so invested in this story, it's like, how much do we tell? You know, they want to know, you know, when do we stop looking and things like that. So that's one of the biggest challenges that I think this situation, this story, can be a teachable moment from the police down to, you know, us in the media. Because I think there are lessons that they need to take, the police need to take from this as far as, you know, when do you, you know, tell people, like, hey, we can't tell you this information right now, but this is where we're going, kind of along what.
And the reason only, I didn't throw that grenade in there to attack, I've known Matt for years, this is not an attack, I've just met Steve today, it's because of the ethical dilemma that we were posed with in that same time frame at my newsroom that same hour 2 days ago, is that we had the same information that the other news outlets had from the same, likely from some of the same sources, I don't know, but we had it, and we chose not to use it because we weren't certain yet that the family had been notified. And so we were on the air for an hour straight, not being able to report, choosing not to report what we knew, because we weren't certain the family had been notified. And in this one specific instance of do we go with our sources or do we go with an official, it made a difference to us because that was the only criterion for making that decision was, did the next of kin know yet from the police that their little girl had been recovered from the water? And if they hadn't, we didn't feel that was something the public had to know at that moment, especially in light of the fact that afterwards we learned that the family, in fact, learned it from smartphone alerts from the media. I don't think that's right.
Or that's the story.
Yeah, and I did. I don't think he specified which family members were alerted, did he?
No, he didn't.
So, I mean, I talked to her, the great-grandmother of Maddox, on the phone, and, I mean, you know, you could be, this side of the room could be the total of the family members we're talking about. I would have to believe, and I can't imagine this is incorrect, that the Syracuse police didn't have somebody with the family at all times. We know that they were patrolled outside their, at least the Valley Drive home, although that's not where the family was hanging out, but I can't imagine. If they didn't have somebody with the family at all times, as Stephen said, then were they doing their job correctly? I mean, with cell phones, and we know that there were some family members down at the Inner Harbor, how could the police not get that information to them before their own people, the police department's own people, started spreading this to other members of the media? That is a gap that, as Iris, I think, alluded to, I can't imagine how that could have happened, quite honestly.
Yeah, I certainly agree. The police have their own issues to deal with there in terms of releasing information. But
it sounds like Channel 9, from what you knew, made a good decision for your station, too. Well, and we felt like we did have the information solid. It was correct. It was right. We went on the air during our CBS 5 noon news and then correspondingly with digital inclusion on that. And we felt it was the right decision for us, and I'm sure from what Stephen is saying, it was the right decision for Syracuse.com and the Post Standard, too.
Stan, if I can add one thing to Dan's point. If we are told, if we explicitly know that a family has yet to be notified, sure, we don't put that out.
Good point.
I just want to be clear about that. That's not a general practice.
Did you ask your source if they knew if the family had been notified before you went with it? You had a source on that fact. Did you ask them, hey, has the family been notified before you went with it, Stephen?
No.
Yeah. I always treat these skeptically over the course of my career, these efforts to withhold information, because for most of my career I worked for an afternoon newspaper, and something would happen the day before, and we'd report it, and close to deadline on the day of publication, so at least 12 hours, often longer than that, you'd hear from the authorities, oh, please don't report that, we haven't notified the family yet. And probably 99% of the time, that was just bogus. They just wanted to control information in a way that is not what we as your representatives trying to get information to you should put up with. So I think what this shows is there's no right or wrong. There's no law about journalism other than Congress shall make no law. And ethical decisions like this come up all the time on all kinds of stories. And we've had a really good example this week that makes it a lot easier to see. I would just come back to a couple of you mentioned the relevant context for important stories. In other words, they're breaking so fast now. How do you make sure you have the context, whether it's whether the police have notified family members or whether this is breaking now and you've got the county executive or the mayor or the governor or a business leader's information to give it the context for all of our readers?
It reminds me of a different story. We'll probably end up back at this one again, but we did a story on a 911 dispatch delay this past fall in a fatal fire in Baldwinsville. Did any of you see the story that we've run on Channel 3 and some on Channel 5, mostly on Channel 3? A man called 911, said difficulty breathing, I can't breathe, him in my apartment, so they sent out the ambulance. But within a minute, he had told the 911 dispatcher, my apartment's filling up with smoke. Fire dispatcher didn't change the call to a apartment fire. The fire escalated, took 4 minutes and 54 seconds before the fire department was sent, and by then he was fading and ultimately died in the fire. Speaking of government is the reason I bring it up at all. In the media, we all covered the fire. We covered the fact that the man died in the fire. It wasn't for 3 more years before we did our investigative story that revealed to the community, and this is a summary of a quote from Bill Bliley, the commissioner of 911, for only the second time in the history of the 911 center, there was a fatality that may have been caused in part by a delay in dispatch. The second time in 25 years, roughly, since the 911 center was opened. Onondaga County never told anybody about it. They never formed a commission to look into why it happened. They didn't follow this happened once before in 1998 with the Lincoln Park Drive fire. The grand jury actually investigated, not criminally, but for building a report and recommendations. And I end up interviewing Joni Mahoney about, and she was probably about the same time she was here a few weeks ago, and I was explaining details about what happened to her during the interview, and then she's responding to it and saying they're going to learn and try to communicate better. But this happened, and nobody knew about it. The family of the victim didn't know it. There was a delay. The fire department that responded didn't know there was a delay. The members of the county legislature who oversee public safety and the budget didn't know there was a delay, or for that matter, that they might be on the hook for some type of legal action should this information get out. So there are times when it's just not in the interest of government to let the community, if from their point of view, to let the community know that they made a mistake. And they make choices to keep those mistakes hidden and secret. And they did plenty of investigating, and actually their response to it, without us knowing about it, was fairly reasonable, the way they looked into it, the way they've changed policies since then. But they didn't tell anybody about it. And there's stories like that that happen, they're happening right now. We don't know what they are. Maybe it'll be 2.5 or 3 years before we know what they are. But it's not always in the interests of the government actors to let the community and the public know what's going on.
You're really talking about good investigative journalism, good skeptical journalism. And the skepticism, especially when you're dealing with people in authority, can be a virtue. You want to challenge what they have to say and make and understand it. This could go on all semester. But you know, at the Newhouse School, I'm sure they have classes. I'll give Stephen the last word, because he's my boss, and then we'll get Eileen for questions. Stephen.
Very briefly, because I responded no to Dan. I have to say no, I didn't know whether the family was notified. But John O'Brien, who was our reporter, who I have great trust in, and John Lammers, who's a director of news, came to me and said, we're doing this, and I have great trust in them. And so I have to bet that there was some knowledge within there. But I can't personally say that I knew that, Dan. So I just want to clarify that point.
Thank you. Eileen, you have some questions from the audience?
I let this run long because it's such a great conversation.
That was long.
So we have probably a little less than 20 minutes for question and answer. And look at all the hands that already have gone up. I'll start over here.
So coming back to a broader context, since I'm from Planned Parenthood, I'd like to ask two things. One is probably best answered by Steve about the ability to anonymously post comments on the Post Standards website. And the second one is when you call Planned Parenthood for a perspective on abortion, the other side that you're presenting is not a healthcare provider, it's a religious perspective. So I'm wondering how you do the apples to apples side of that story.
I don't understand the first question. The answer is yes, we do allow anonymous. So does Facebook.
Why?
I'm sorry. You can fill it out. You can fulfill your name in. Why do you all fill it out as anonymous? Why don't you put your name on it? Ah. No, we don't require it, or there would be no conversation. It's the web. I'm sorry, it's the web. And it carries on. And let me tell you one thing. I got a letter recently from someone, and I actually got another note last night from them, complaining drastically about comments. And they talked to me about the conversations going on and how badly they were treated. And then they said, and I want to know why you banned me 50 times. I mean, you would...
50 times.
I mean, we have people who you would not believe the dialogue that's there and how we continue to evolve it. You know, if you go back to Mr. Ben Franklin and his peers, they used to write stories under pseudonyms. You didn't know who they were. They had crazy names. I can't remember them. So it's just the evolution of news. And if you look at 5 years ago, and you look at even 8 or 10 years ago, the comments are far more managed. It's far, far better of a dialogue. And I would challenge you to go through them and look at all of them. Don't just look at one set. We might be firefighting one set super hard, but I'll bet you that there's another 50 that there's reasonable dialogue going on about SU basketball, et cetera.
Can I just touch on your other question just really briefly? That's a real challenge of the apples to oranges of sources. And the only thing you can do is we'd rather run the story, so we would rather have the sources, but our challenge is to put the sources into context. So you kind of have to count on an audience to know one of these perspectives is coming from that religious whatever it is on whatever the issue is. Put them in context by identifying who it is. You know, we have a rule in our newsroom that the person has to be identified, name and title or description, before you hear from them. So you're not hearing from somebody and going, huh, what's their perspective? And then ideally, if you have the time, I mean, Dan was talking about how brief everything has to be, you say a little more about what they said besides just the sound bite, so that you get a little sense of, well, where are they coming from? But then it's kind of up to an audience to put that into context. But we can spend a little more time with some stories, so we have a little bit of an advantage in that regard. We still want the story. We would rather have the story on, and we'd rather have it sourced from both sides, if you will, although many stories have multiple sides. So the more context we could put is the way that the apples and oranges all become fruit, at least.
Good morning. Thank you for the interesting dialogue this morning and for your important contributions to the community. I'm assuming that most, if not all of you, have seen the recent film Spotlight, and I'm wondering about your perspective. It seems to me that it brings up a lot of these issues of ethical dilemmas. I know it's, you know, it's a different context, but I just wondered about your reactions. Do you think it's relatively realistic, helpful?
I don't know if it's going to win the Oscar, or I might finish second or third Sunday night, but I love the film from the point of view that it reminded me of watching All the President's Men from Another Generation, and whenever that comes on, I watch it again, because it does, that sense of story that's within it does, I think, inspire journalists to do better work. But I thought the most fascinating thing in terms of ethics within that movie is the overarching power of large figures in the community. In this case, it was the Bishop of Boston, but also everybody else, the whole kind of Catholic Boston tradition, political figures, religious figures, who were smiling as they were pressuring the newspaper to not cover this. They're buying them a drink when they're not. They're saying, "Oh, let this go. This is just little Johnny down the street. We're bigger than this. We don't want to let this get out." That's so dangerous. And what a great example of how after making their own mistakes for many years, by their own admission, the Boston Globe team and Michael Keaton's character in the movie, they finally reported the story to really bring this whole thing down. One would hope in our community, and we, it's easy, I know, Dan, you know how this is too, where you see a Joni Mahoney or a Stephanie Miner, or I should mention Steve Aiello, I guess, in that context too. You'll see people like that, and they're your friend. We're on TV, they know us, we're friendly with them, but we don't know when tomorrow the story's going to flip where we have to be challenging them. And that's important for us to keep in mind, that we're not really, really their friends as long as we're still doing this job. So keep that in mind, everybody out there.
So Spotlight shows, to get back to this, can be too cozy with people who tell you,
and it's
don't
it is tempting.
Out.
I'll tell you, it is tempting. It's tempting. Dan and I were at the Vatican for Mother Mary Ann Cope, and we're riding on shuttle buses with the bishop and maybe having some wine. Down, too.
Just a little.
But.
For religious purposes.
Right, only, it was blessed. It was definitely blessed. But, so you're their friend. And for that trip, you know, there's nothing wrong with a good dose of sainthood to get you through a trip. And to feel good about doing the reporting about the magnificence and the glory of that all. However, when we come back here, do we need to do a story about the Catholic Church? And maybe something that the bishop is involved in, or it's a Planned Parenthood story, and we're looking for reaction from the Catholic diocese. So cozy's not so good.
Thank you for the segue when you mentioned all the president's men. I'm interested in what is fair and balanced. And I'd be interested in knowing to whether or not, to which extent, Trump is a function of media in the way they have responded to him, or whether or not this is a function of Trump.
I think that's another Thursday morning roundtable.
We'll be back next week to talk about Trump.
How about the first Thursday in November after the election?
I think
President-elect Donald Trump.
I don't know, Stan, do you want to go there? I think Donald Trump is
Let's talk about it.
A function of the Republican Party, and they've kind of created him and led to his candidacy. He is a phenomenally interesting figure. I don't think the media has done anything but open the microphones and the cameras and let him talk. And it would be very interesting to see how it goes between now and next Tuesday, and between next Tuesday and the conventions. And therefore, but I think Donald Trump and his continued remarkable, astonishing success is a function of what the Republican Party has created for itself coming into 2016. He's the only one. If he's the only one left standing after the conventions, I think it's more of a function of where our two-party system has gotten to, and where the Republican Party has allowed itself to get to this year. Where Donald Trump is still leading and actually has a better chance of winning the nomination every day.
You know what, though? I agree with the Republican comment you make. I disagree with the media. The media is absolutely complicit. Donald Trump can be on any... None of the media here. Nobody here. Well, no, because you know what I'm saying. We're not making decisions to put Donald Trump on. I'm talking about MSNBC, Fox News. They will have Trump on every morning and every afternoon if he'll agree to it, because he's the
It's because you want to see it.
Well, but he's the candle, and the moth flies to the candle.
Oh, but even those of you who are shaking your said, no, I'm not a Donald Trump supporter, you're watching. Okay.
Well,
I'm telling you, you collectively are watching.
It's a good point, because somebody is, but I would say the media is complicit in absolutely saying, well, forget balance and forget he's the shiny penny. We're going to put him on. And he's on every single day. He's on somebody's cable station every single day. No other candidate.
Well, he also happens to be the leading candidate of his party for the presidency of the United States.
Sure.
And that's big news in 2016. Regardless of what you think about him or how he got there or how he manages to stay where he is in the polls, he is a leading candidate of one of the two major parties in our country for president. You have to pay attention to him, whether you like it or not.
The only issue that I've had with our coverage, and I've expressed it and really tried to crank my team on it, is if the guy is a hangnail, we don't need to cover it. If he challenges something tied to the Pope, yeah, I expect to see it. But we, at the outset, it was like, he did something. He drank water. I was like, stop, stop, stop. But I'm with Dan. I mean, he is the leading candidate of one of two major parties in this country for president that can impact this country 8 years and beyond. So he is going to get covered.
In many ways, this is a good segue into my question. Mm-hmm. And since you've all gone digital, sometimes better ways than others. Is a digital count used to judge reporters? Is it part of my old-fashioned conservative me says that a lot of news isn't terribly popular, and are good people being punished for not reporting on popular things?
No, not with us. I'm going to tell you, I had this discussion yesterday, in fact. The state of the state, how many of you looked at that, care about that? Yeah, thank you for a couple hands going up. And I won't point out those of you who aren't really telling the full truth, because then I'll have to start asking you what it all said. We cover it. We have to cover it. I've said, look, do we look at popularity tied to entertainment and sports? Yeah. Yeah, we want to know what people are interested in. That guides us. I tell my staff frequently, there's three topics that we must cover in Syracuse, and it's clear. It's weather, Syracuse basketball, and it's weather.
How come you guys don't have a meteorologist on staff?
We don't need one. We're doing pretty damn well without one.
because we have to spend our time, and I'm speaking on the behalf of Chief Meteorologist Wayne Mahar, when I say...
Wayne's a nice guy.
When Stephen's staff posts a story saying there's going to be 14 inches of snow, and you all read it, and it doesn't snow at all at Drumlin's that day, then Wayne's on the air explaining, well, some people are saying that there could be 14 inches of snow. But it's lake effect. That's going to be in the Jefferson County. It's at Southwick Beach today, not here at Drumlin's.
Very good, Wayne.
Okay. No.
Or something like that. So.
Wait. I get to defend that.
Okay. Wait, you got to do it in a Wayne Mahar voice, though.
You know, I think that we've done well doing it in the manner we are. And I would challenge that when we put up the interactive map that shows you the snowfall that's going to happen in your area, almost to the neighborhood, that's better than anyone can do on TV. So I'm going to defend Glenn Coyne, who I think does a fantastic job.
He's a good reporter, but he's not a meteorologist.
Several of you have mentioned balance and showing both sides of a story. My concern, and particularly at the national level, when you're getting opinion, not from two different folks, especially in politics, there's very little fact-checking. There's very little, gee, that just isn't true. There's very little challenge to people making statements that aren't just opinion, but they're stated as facts, especially in the political scene. Do you have a comment on that?
Iris, I think you wanted to talk about that, didn't you?
I think it's impossible to fact check everything, that the volume of everything that is out there anymore. I think we try and look at it and read it. I have very knowledgeable people around politics who look at and read stuff and will question and will pull back and will contact, say it's the Washington Post syndicate we may be using. They'll reach out and say, hey, I'm not quite sure about this. But we can't possibly fact check everything that's out there. There has to be a certain, as I've said before, good housekeeping reliability brand that if it's come through the Washington Post syndicate, they've already done their work or they're out of business too.
I think we do a good job of checking facts on our local politicians.
I agree with that.
Which is what that's what we do here. And same whether we take a story that comes from NBC News, CBS News, Sinclair Broadcasting, CNN, those stories come to us with a bow on them, and we are trusting that the source that we are in tandem with is going to do that part. I'd love to see more of it, but it is challenging.
Some of that is done before the journalist, if it's done correctly, having some background. So when I'm talking to somebody, I mean, I can always say so-and-so said, and then whatever he said is attributed, so it's not me saying it, it's him saying it or her, which isn't quite, you know, that's not good, right? Because we're just allowing them to say anything unchallenged. So some background knowledge at least allows you to kind of have the BS meter going, and then you can choose to or not put it on. I mean, they're all judgment calls, and your point probably could be levied against almost any story that had a source giving an opinion. But to me, I think the foreknowledge is where you kind of get a sense of, is this worth saying, or is this either absolutely untrue, totally an opinion, based in anything, but it's a great point.
I would just jump in because that surprised me, because I think there's more fact-checking going on now than throughout my entire career, and it's easy to find. We check locally, but so nationally, you can go to any number of places, PolitiFact, the Washington Post, the Tampa Bay Times, Snopes, they go on and on. Organizations that do really good jobs of fact-checking statements from politicians, business leaders, or many others, but you do have to go find them. But you now have that opportunity to understand what might be true or false and find out if somebody's really branded as liar, liar, pants on fire. So
We have time for one more question.
We really have an issue with it because we have student reporters. You know, probably about half of our news coverage is students. We don't present that as a student product. We present it as a professional product. So trying to get them knowledge before they go so they know what to ask and know if it's above board. And then after the fact, trying to say, huh, they said that. Is that really true, whether it's a number or an opinion or so on? So it's a really good point.
I have to admit to being a fan of MSNBC. But they start at 7 o'clock, for example, one of these outstanding stories, and run four different editions, each an hour long. It almost reminds me of what they call Parkinson's Law, and that is the amount of news expands to the time available.
Yeah.
Is there some issue of ethics in this, the fact that it's such an overload on MSNBC?
There's an overload everywhere. And I think that's part of the whole issue that maybe come back to where we start. There's so much, so many platforms, digital and otherwise, and the 24/7 news cycle that now goes back decades is just, there's so many channels of information available, and we fill it with something. So you have the opportunity to tune out, too. I would encourage you to do so if it's to be overload.
Stan, can I say one thing?
Sure.
I know we're going to wrap up. I want to thank you all for your patronage of what we do, what all of us do. We wouldn't do it without you. We do it representing you. I will always welcome your feedback and comments to me, as I'm sure everyone on this panel would. We strive every day. We're not perfect. We're imperfect people. We strive every day to deliver to you the information. Just as Chief said, I'm a crime fighter. You know, I'm a news gatherer. And we strive every day to deliver that to you. So thank you for your support of us. And thank you for your feedback to us.
Thank you all for coming this morning. It was a delight. We really appreciated your time.